Good morning.
Recording in progress.
Good morning.
So, a few weeks ago, I gave a talk on how the Buddha came to practice, I think last month. And I told this story about how Shakyamuni Buddha went out four times with his charioteer to the local village, and that he saw for the first time in his life an old person, a sick person, a dead person, and a monk. And since he had not seen a sick person, an old person, a dead person, or a monk in all of his life, he was kind of taken aback and wondered what was wrong with these folks. And his charioteer said, well, this is what happens to everyone, not the monk part, but the other three. And we get sick. We die, and if we're lucky, we get old. And so he was deeply disturbed by this. Talked about this during that lecture. And he didn't want to experience that kind of suffering that he had seen that those people were experiencing. So on the fourth visit, he met the monk, the mendicant, and he said, you know, what are you up to, basically? And the monk said, observing the transiency of this world, old age, illness, and death, I seek to liberate myself. I seek to liberate myself from this suffering through the Dharma. He says, guided by the true Dharma. So when Siddhartha heard this, he thought to himself, you know, this is for me. This is what I want. And that was the awakening of his mind of bodhicitta at that point. So he wanted to seek liberation through the religious path. And as we know, he kind of kept that secret for a while, but then eventually he left his home, he left his wife, he left his son, and he looked for a teacher to teach him about this liberation. Now, according to the biographies, he studied with two teachers, and he was like A1 ace student. He was so good that after a few years, the teacher said, you're so good, you're such a great learner, you're such a great student, why don't you co-teach with me? You can become the co-teacher. And both times, Siddhartha said, no, I don't want to do that, because he realized that he hadn't found liberation. So he left both of those teachers, both of those opportunities, and then he became an ascetic monk. And he only ate a little bit, he only drank a little bit, and he got really super skinny, and still, he didn't find liberation. So as we know, finally he sat down under what is now called the Bodhi tree, and he went into a deep meditative state. So during this time, many things happened to him, and he had many insights. But from those insights came what we call the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is an end to suffering, and the end is the Eightfold Path. So these were the words, they were the summation of his awakening, this path, these Four Noble Truths. And this was his distillation of the identification of suffering, the nature of suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path of how to achieve the end of that suffering. And at that point, he left and started teaching. There was a little gap in there where he was not sure whether or not he should teach. Depends on the version of the story. And I think it was maybe Vishnu. Not Vishnu. I can't remember which one of the Hindu gods it was who came to him and said, you know, you should teach. So please teach. So he decided to teach. So what I want to talk about today is I'm going to talk about how we can use the Four Noble Truths to practice. How we can use them to identify and work with our problems. So the first one is there is suffering. So I think we would all agree that at various times we experience suffering. And we are in pain emotionally or physically. And mainly what I want to talk about today is how we deal with emotional suffering. And I want to talk about our usual suffering. So not the suffering that happens in extraordinary circumstances, but the usual suffering that we go through. So being angry, being judgmental, finding ourselves feeling greedy, unwilling to help, resistances, those kinds of problems that we deal with every day in practice. So this way that we start where we are, as Pema Chodron's famous book is titled, you know, we start where we are and deal with the problems that we have right now. And it really helps, as I've said before, to deal with small things because we build up muscles. It's like going to the practice gym, you know, and we build up these muscles of practice. And then when the big things happen, we're more able to deal with them. So where does suffering reside? So this first part, there is suffering. Where does suffering reside? I would say it resides in our body and our mind. And our body and our mind are not different. They're the same event. But we like to, you know, separate them. So we experience emotional and physical pain in our bodies and in our minds. So a key beginning, if you will, a key aspect of enacting practice is to recognize that we're suffering in the first place. So this is key, to realize that we're actually experiencing suffering. And that suffering that we're experiencing and our attempts to get away from that suffering are often the genesis of our unskillful actions. So we start there. And Ganjo Koan Dogen says, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. A great realization about delusion. So that's a good place to start, having a great realization about delusion. So delusion in Sanskrit is moha, and it means confusion, foolishness, and ignorance. And the confusion and the ignorance that we have are about our conceptions of self and about the phenomenal world. So that pretty much covers all the bases. And it's considered an affliction in Buddhism, and it's considered a primary cause of suffering. So I would say that delusion is kind of an umbrella word that covers what we're talking about. It refers to our basic ignorance about the true nature of who we are and what we refer to as the other is. And this is a root cause of suffering. So exploring this and finding out about this is, I would say, the first step in cultivating great realization about delusion. So the first thing is, where do we get caught? And where we get caught, as each one of us has our own thing that we get caught on. So, and we can feel it in our bodies when that arises, when this kind of suffering comes up, and that it's caused by your delusion and your acknowledgement of that. So, for example, in many, many, many situations, I'm fairly patient. But when I'm driving my car, I'm impatient. And I can feel it in my body. Impatience in your body is like this pressure. At least this is how I feel it. It's a kind of pressure that I'm leaning against almost that's coming. And it's painful. If you pay attention to the sensation, that sensation is uncomfortable. So there's an indicator. Besides my mental state, I can feel it in my body. So that we acknowledge that we're suffering. This is suffering, that it's actually uncomfortable. Greed is uncomfortable. Anger is uncomfortable. Impatience is uncomfortable. all of these experiences that we have that lead to suffering. Now, not all pain that we experience, I would say, necessarily leads to unskillful response. So I'm talking about the things that lead us to be unskillful. I would not say that grief necessarily is something that leads us to become unskillful. But many, many of these experiences that we characterize as suffering, because we're have such aversion to having the feeling that we don't want to acknowledge it at all. So the first step is to acknowledge that you're caught by this, that you want to get away from this, that it pushes your buttons. And each one of us has our own version of where that is. So we have to get aware of what it is about each one of us, yeah, about ourselves, that gets us upset. So we are, you know, we want to alleviate our suffering. We want to get away from it. We don't like it. And because we don't really know how to do that, we get caught in delusion. And we engage and perpetuate delusion because of this. So I want to say here, this is the first step. To actually feel and know that you are suffering. Feel and know that we are suffering. So big emotions are often a clue to this. We're super, you know, kind of go into these big emotional states. And if you think about it, even laughing too much is painful, right? It's like people, they're going to, remember when you're a little kid, people want to tickle you? Be like, no, please don't tickle me. It's so painful, you know? That's supposed to be fun. So any of the, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have joy or any of those kinds of things, but what I'm saying is if we pay attention, these are clues when we find ourselves getting really upset about something or really emotionally involved. This is a clue. This is a place where we can say, am I suffering? Am I physically, mentally suffering at this moment? So we feel it in our bodies. And as I mentioned, you know, I might feel impatient when I'm driving my car. Maybe you'll feel impatient at the supermarket, you know, and the feelings of that, or feeling judgmental about something, and people aren't doing what we want them to do or what we think they should do, and the feelings that come up. Sometimes if I'm driving and I think, you know, why can't that person, like, drive faster in front of me? Why can't they go faster? And so I'm like, I want to say, what's wrong with you, the person ahead of me, that you're not driving faster? But you know something? I'm the one who's suffering. And I'm the one who's creating the suffering. And I'm the one who's feeling the suffering. They're not feeling it. They're just going about their business. So, you know, it resides in me. And it is essentially my responsibility. You've probably heard that expression, you know, it says, nobody makes us suffer. Nobody can make us have a particular feeling. This is a feeling that is generated through our own causes and conditions and our own clashes. So some of these emotions are very, you know, clear to us, and some of them are much more subtle. So, but if we pay attention, remember that axiom in Zen, in Buddhism, pay attention. That we pay attention to our life. We pay attention to what's going on in our bodies. We pay attention to when we're in a situation that we don't want. And this is suffering. And we feel it in our bodies. So that's the first noble truth. There is suffering. The second noble truth is there is a cause of suffering. So what are the causes of suffering? Often they're called the three poisons: greed, hate, and delusion. So here we have the resisting what we don't want, and this is characterizing as pushing something away, so hating something. This is the basic category of anger, impatience, all those kinds of emotions fall in that category. So the first one is resisting what we don't want. Feeling we're not getting enough of what we want, and that becomes greed. So that becomes something like the precept of taking what is not given, wanting to take something that's not being offered because we feel like we're not getting something that we should have. We don't get enough of whatever it is. Maybe an extreme version of that is hoarding, There's a woman who lives in, you know, in the park that I live in, and she's a hoarder. You can tell because there are like boxes and boxes and boxes piled up in her driveway that she buys from Amazon. And her house is completely filled with stuff. You can see it through the window. So here's this person who's trying to, deeply trying to alleviate her suffering by buying stuff. And these boxes aren't even open. They're weathered and the cardboard is all shriveled up. And, you know, it's like just piles of things. So, you know, this, but this is a desire to alleviate suffering. It's not like this person is a bad person. They're suffering in some deep way that they think that, that this hoarding that they're engaged in is going to make them feel safer, make them feel happier. And so, you know, they get caught in this. The next one is thinking you can get what you want and not, let's see, thinking that you can get what you want and not getting it. And let's see if I can say this right. In other words, getting something you don't want. So the first one is resisting what we don't want. Feeling, the second one is feeling we're not getting enough. The third one is thinking we can get what we want and not what we don't want, okay? Thinking we can get what we want and not what we don't want. So it's kind of like McDonald's saying, having it your way. So this is considered to be delusion. And then the fourth one is called the desire for re-becoming. And the fourth one is our perpetuating the status of the self. So this attachment to re-becoming is at the heart of trying to maintain our self-identity at all costs. So an extreme example with this would be the white supremacy movement. So in the white supremacy movement, they're trying to alleviate their suffering because they are afraid that others who are not like them will annihilate them, annihilate their way of life. And so they are willing to harm other people in order to create this environment they think they can perpetuate the self. Okay, does that make sense? This desire to perpetuate the self and this understanding of some realm that that self lives in. So white supremacy is an extreme example of this. But if we look closely at our own actions, we may see that we do this ourselves in similar ways. So, for example, we're judgmental about others that we fear are exhibiting things that we perceive in ourselves as being flaws. So we don't like somebody who's doing something or is in some way that we're afraid that we ourselves are like that. So we have to perpetuate our sense of self by rejecting that person as being less than we are so that we can feel better about ourselves. So it looks like everybody's going, yeah, I know that place. So we've, you know, we've all done that thing, you know, and we know what that's like. So what is it that we do that perpetuates the self? Are there certain situations where we feel like we're always right, no compromise? That's a kind of perpetuation of self. Way of saying, well, I know this about myself. I'm absolutely right. I'm always right about this. Therefore, that kind of way of being is about perpetuating the self. So believing that your opinions are always correct. That's a way that we bolster our self-image. So I would say the practice of these two, first two noble truths, is first we realize we're suffering from something and it doesn't feel good. So if you're feeling judgmental about somebody else, that's a clue that maybe there's some suffering going on and it's not them, it's you who's perpetuating the suffering for yourself. So it doesn't feel good. and you realize that you've caused this suffering and you would like to end this suffering. So you may feel anger or greed or delusion or whatever that might be, some uncomfortable emotion. And so you would just say to yourself, oh, this is suffering. So in the past, you might have blamed somebody else, or in the present, in my case, driving my car, it's the fault of the person ahead of me who's driving slower than I want them to drive. That's so you're wanting to blame the other. Or you would just want to dismiss it and not even acknowledge that you're feeling suffering. The other thing, and this is a pitfall to this kind of practice, is that we have to be really careful about not blaming ourselves in a very unproductive way. We have to be really careful about not abusing ourselves or beating ourselves up for these perceived mistakes or this perceived suffering that we are causing ourselves. We have to be gentle with ourselves and gentle with other people. So this practice is not about identifying characteristics in the self that need to be stomped out, and you know that we need to tell ourselves what bad people we are because we're feeling these feelings. It's not like that at all. It's just a matter of saying, oh yeah, guess what, boys and girls, I'm suffering, and I might actually have something to do with why I'm suffering, and maybe I want to look at that. You know, talking about the Four Noble Truths this way in some ways is very much a sort of steps and stages practice. So it's very much a way of problem solving in a certain way. There is a problem. The problem is suffering. How am I going to work with my suffering? It's not about I'm a bad person at all. So you realize there's a problem, that you're suffering or you're causing suffering. And you can run through the causes of suffering. You can actually say, oh, am I in a situation where I'm getting something I don't want? Am I in a situation where I'm not getting what I want? Am I in a situation where I'm getting something I don't want? Am I in a situation where I'm trying to perpetuate my sense of self? Can I ease up on that? Open the hand, you know, and try to let go of that. Where am I getting stuck? So you can ask yourself these questions, and that leads to the third noble truth. And the third noble truth is, there is an end to suffering. I have to tell you a kind of a funny story. I went to, I was at Blockbusters. You know, remember Blockbusters back in the day? And I don't know how this came up. I think somebody, I was checking out, and the clerk said, and I told her my name was Shinshu, and she said, oh, well, that's interesting. That's a weird name. How come your name is Shinshu? And I said something like, you know, I'm a Buddhist priest or whatever. And this woman behind me said, what do Buddhists believe in? And I'm like, oh, no. That, right? And I said something like, well, do you have a religion? And she said, yes, I'm Catholic. And I said, well, what do you believe in? Now, I know there are some Catholic people here or former Catholics in the room. And so I can't remember what she said. You'll probably be able to reel it off. But it was something like, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ and he died for me or something like that. What's the creed of the
Apostles' Creed?
And how does that go?
I believe in God, Father of my being. Did that trigger?
She just reeled. She just.
Son, our Lord.
That's right. She reeled it off,
was
right? It was like. So she reeled this off, and I'm like going, "Oh my goodness, what am I going to say in response to that?" And I only thing I could come up with is, "There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There is an end of suffering in the Eightfold Path." So that was my, you know, and you know, in Zen and Buddhism, we have all these lists. We have, gosh, we have the paramitas, and we've got, you know, the precepts, and we have the four of this and the eight of that and the what of that. And, you know, I'm like going, what in the world am I going to say? Sit Zazen. There you go. So anyway, the third one is there is an end to suffering. So, you know, we're now we've woken up to the fact that there's a problem, and we really feel like suffering is a problem, and that we are motivated to practice. And we begin to think that through this practice, we might find a way to create more happiness, if you will, stability, a calm mind for ourselves and others. So, you know, in our practice, in Soto Zen and some other, and in other Buddhist schools as well, our belief is that as human beings, we're going to suffer. I mean, like, it's, you can't avoid it. And that in this lifetime, we are going to suffer with grief and desire and other ways that cause difficulties for ourselves and others. So, you know, what changes through this practice is our relationship to suffering. And by changing that relationship, we suffer less than we might have otherwise, and we cause less suffering than we do when we are caught. And so by uncatching ourselves, it doesn't mean that we will never feel grief, we will never be lonely, we will never be angry. It doesn't mean that we get to avoid all of that, but it means that how that's going to be expressed, if it's going to be expressed, all of those ways are going to be transformed. So from our perspective, it is about transformation. It's not about cutting something off. And it is about not being caught by it. So it's important that we wake up and put our effort into the practice to create this transformation. So we wake up to our pettiness. We wake up to the suffering that's caused through our pettiness, and that we become aware of our ignorance. We do the practice. We see the places that we're caught, and we do our best to transform what is unskillful to what is skillful. So this original teaching was created as part of a system to get off the wheel of birth and death. And by getting off the wheel of birth and death, one would enter into this state, if you will. It's unclear exactly what this is, called nirvana. And you would not ever be reborn again, and therefore this would be the end of the suffering that was caused by being in a body, being in the form realm. In Mahayana practice, the kleshas that pull the bodhisattva back into the next lifetime, as I said before, are about the desire to save all beings. So we come back into this lifetime. Now, the very high-level bodhisattva, we say, is of this world, but not in this world, not caught by this. I would say, looking around the room in my own experience, none of us are at that place yet. We're all still caught, you know, by the suffering that we experience. So, but the end game that we're working towards is not getting rid of rebirth as a problem. Actually, rebirth is an opportunity for us to practice. It's an opportunity to go and to keep working on this process of trying to figure out and understand how it is that we can alleviate the suffering of self and others, and as we go along, in particular, to alleviate the suffering of all beings. But right now, I'm not concerned about necessarily alleviating the suffering of all beings. I'm more concerned with how we can practice to alleviate our own suffering in this moment, and therefore alleviate the suffering of the others who are around us, other people who are with us. And this is our practice that we do. So if you're new to Buddhism or you're exploring Buddhism, hopefully this makes sense to you. For those of us who've been practicing for a long time, I think we believe this, we have faith in this as a path statement about how to work with our afflictive emotions. So I think this aspect of faith is really important as we enter into and continue to practice. I think this teaching that we can work through suffering, we can end suffering in this way, transform suffering into something that is more skillful, involves kind of intelligent faith, is what I would call it. It's a logic that the teachings make sense to us, and where they don't perhaps feel particularly clear to us, that we make that leap into actually doing the practice, even though we may not understand how it works. Like, for example, coming and sitting zazen is a faith. It's a kind of leap into that activity, that something is happening even though you can't see in that moment exactly what that is. That you have this faith in that practice. So we're encouraged to make this leap, if you will. We're encouraged to continue this effort through the Sangha, through fellow practitioners, sister practitioners, our Dharma friends, and with the teachers that we work with, and also the things that we read and the things that we study inspire us. Other people's practice inspire us. And furthermore, in our school, we believe that every one of us is endowed with the mind of Buddha. Every one of us already has this capacity to wake up, to become awakened. So there's an out of that capacity, because we are already the nature of Buddha, that means that we have this natural desire to want to wake up, that it's built into our psyches to want to wake up, to want to do what is good and what is wholesome. So this is also a Dharma gate to the transformation of our suffering. Now the fourth of them is the Eightfold Path, and technically the Eightfold Path is right view, right thinking, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So I'm not going to go into what those all are about, because essentially they cover in some version or other all of the various permutations of Buddhist practice. But for us, this path, as Soto Zen practitioners, for us this path is about Sangha, it's about coming together with each other, it's about sitting zazen, it's about doing the forms together, it's about talking about practice together, it's about being with each other. It's all of these things that we do as Soto Zen practitioners. And out of that path comes our understanding. So, again, first you wake up to your own delusion, your particular situation that you're currently experiencing right now, right in front of you. You can kind of run through this. So you go through what the problem is. What do you want? What do you not want? What are you holding on to? And how are you trying to alleviate your suffering? Is it working? Is it workable? Is it a problem? Is it creating more suffering? Don't blame others. Look to your own mind, because we are responsible for our feelings. Nobody makes us feel anything. But again, this is not about guilt. It's not about recrimination. It's not about judgment or punishing yourself or the other person. It's just opening up to what's really happening. Just being aware of what's actually happening around you and in you. Working with a teacher is very helpful at this point. So as you go along, you find that you can do this practice, you can do this process right on the spot as you're experiencing suffering. And then again, this requires faith in the teachings. It requires faith that this works. And for most of us, it requires a community to practice in, and a teacher for guidance. So I would say these are the conditions that lead towards the discovery of what's going on for us, how to work with it, and it enables us to follow this path. So I'm going to end this talk about this by saying that each one of us has ways of practicing that resonate for us as a particular personality or human being, our causes and conditions. And for some of us, it may be a very devotional practice. That may be what really resonates for us. For some of us, it's a very intuitive practice. So our practice is based on a kind of intuitive understanding. And for some people, it's more intellectual. And the other thing is that we don't have to think of it as this or this or this. We think of it like a three-lane highway that you're, you know, sometimes this is what we're doing and sometimes this other thing is what we're doing. So if talking about the Four Noble Truths is helpful for you today and it's just right for you, that's great. If it's not, that's fine too. Part of the practice, I think, is how we find the way of what actually works for us, what resonates for us in our practice. So finding our way involves trying different things and sticking with our effort as we try different things. And doing, essentially, no matter what the thing is that you're doing, it's usually hard work. Transformation of the self is hard, you know? It's hard to honestly face who we are and to look at the ways that we're doing things that are unskillful and then not beating ourselves up, because as soon as we beat ourselves up, we of course feel aversion to the practice. Who wants to do something that makes you feel bad about yourself? So that's not the point of this. So this way in which we really just settle into who we are and make our best effort in the situation that we're in, using our practice. So it's not about, you know, as I'm having a what's-her-face talks in a poem about crawling across the desert.
Mary Oliver.
This is not about, you know, crawling across the desert, beating yourself up. As Dogen says in Fukan Sazengi, please, honored followers of the way, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not doubt the true dragon. So I'll just end by saying, let's keep practicing together. Thank you very much.